Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Justine Rotolo, also known as Miss ADD, and I want to welcome everybody to the program today. Also say Happy New Year. I haven't been on live for 2 weeks. I hope you took advantage of my other podcasts to listen to them during that time. So today I'm excited, really excited about this show. We're going to have Natasha Tracy on. Natasha is an award-winning writer and speaker from the Pacific Northwest. She specializes in writing about bipolar disorder, depression, pharmacology, and other mental health issues. She is also the creator of Bipolar Burple, which is how I found her, because she posts things about bipolar on Facebook, which has been very helpful for me because my son, who was on my program in November, has hypomania, which is the same kind of bipolar that Natasha is a challenge for her as it is with my son. So before I bring Natasha on, I just want to remind everybody, if you're in the Los Angeles area, to please come by to our adult support group that I run through CHAD, Children and Adults with ADD. It's every Wednesday night from 7:30 to 9. It's a powerful group, and I would hope that if you're in the Los Angeles area that you would come by and join us. Also, my book is out. It's available on my website, missadd.com. It's also on amazon.com. And the name of it is ADD Land, The Gift of ADD. So please go on and buy it and enjoy the fact that whoever is listening that has attention deficit disorder, that you have a gift. So I'm not sure if Tracy has called in. She's on the line. Okay, 1 second. Tracy?
Hi, Natasha, yes.
Oh, Natasha, I'm sorry. I'm calling you by your last name. I'm sorry.
That's
how
okay.
Are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And I really want to thank you again for being on the show.
Not a problem.
So what I would like to start off with, if you don't mind, is if you could tell everybody about your journey, you know, through the whole world of bipolar. That would be, I think, very interesting to everybody who's listening.
Sure. So a little bit about me. When I was younger, I didn't have the best home life in the world. And when I was a teenager, I actually first started exhibiting signs of mental illness, which in my particular case, I was exhibiting signs of depression at that time.
Okay.
However, even though I was seeing professionals at the time, no one ever suggested that it might be a mental illness.
How old were you at this time?
So it started around age 13.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's pretty normal to find it difficult to tell the difference between a mental illness at that age and just normal teen angst.
Okay.
Right? And because I didn't have the best home life, people thought perhaps that may be what was causing the issue and not any underlying disorder.
Okay.
And so and of course that's what I thought as well. It never occurred to me that I would have a mental illness. That never entered my head. I knew nothing about mental illness.
Okay.
Then when I did leave home, I did have a period of normalcy that lasted about a year. And I figured that I was fine and everything was okay. But then things just started to slide for me. And by the time I was 20 years old, I was in a very, very severe depression and was going to see a counselor at the university where I was.
Okay.
And once I told the counselor all of my symptoms, everything that had been happening to me, the counselor said to me, "You need to see a doctor." And that was actually the first time that I had ever seen a doctor for my mental health, because the way I was brought up, you didn't go to doctors for mental health, and psychiatrists were just drug pushers.
Exactly.
That's how I was brought up. So it would never occur to me to see one. But okay. at that time, I was in such a severe state that I was really desperate. And so the fact that this counselor referred me to one, I did end up going and seeing a doctor. And eventually that did lead to my diagnosis of bipolar disorder. But the official diagnosis took probably a year. And I was initially misdiagnosed with just unipolar depression.
Okay. So I guess one of my questions would be, when did you first experience a manic episode?
So as you were talking about earlier, I experienced hypomanic episodes, which are
okay.
different than manic episodes in
okay.
that they are
okay.
not as severe. So,
right.
So I've experienced hypomanic episodes ever since I was a kid. If
okay.
you were to ask my mother, for example, she would be able to tell you that there were times when I was so excited and excitable and so beyond what a normal child would
right.
do in terms of energy and play and activity and talking and thought, that it was very noticeable. Now, of course, no one at that time would have ever called it a hypomanic episode, but as I grew older, it was clearer to me that I did have unusual fits of energy, basically.
Okay. Okay.
And so for me, those were always short-lived. And so that's one of the reasons I was misdiagnosed, because for me, a hypomanic episode might only last a day or a few days. And so
okay.
that's fairly irregular in bipolar disorder and harder to catch.
Okay. So for my listening audience, and most of them that are listening today most likely are ADD, ADHD, and for myself, in dealing with my son, when he was a little boy, what you're describing is exactly what I used to see with him, that uncontrollable energy and the talking, couldn't stop talking, and the thoughts were also very pervasive. He was depressed a lot during his childhood, and it seemed like any kind of antidepressant that we ever put him on, it really disinhibited him. It
mm-hmm.
didn't really help with the depression. You know, he would do things, and there was no sorrow, which really wasn't him. He was babysitting one time for somebody and was throwing darts in their wall, which was totally a different child than I knew, because when he came home to the house and we had found out about it, there was no, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry. And so we would run the gamut. We were running the gamut with medication, taking him off antidepressants, then putting him on mood stabilizers like Zyprexa and Risperidol and Seroquel. And, you know, they would work for a little while and then they would stop. And why am I talking about this is because there are a lot of people out there in the world of ADHD that what happens is they tell me a lot about their children being in these extreme places when it comes to, you know, even anger outbursts. They're raging. And so I'm wondering, from your expertise, would you be looking, as that child gets older, for bipolar disorder or hypomania? What's your take on that?
Yeah, so, you know, the distinctive quality, of course, of bipolar disorder is to exhibit both the elevated and the depressed moods. So
okay.
you would have to have a child who is exhibiting both of those mood types. And,
right.
of course, in a child, depression can actually manifest as irritability. So
yes.
sometimes it's not recognized because it's not the kind of depression you see in an adult. But in a
right.
child, it's an extreme irritability situation. So that's a bit unusual for them. So if
right.
I had a child
right.
that had prolonged periods of, you know, an elevated mood and prolonged periods of a depressed mood, and these moods were not reactive to the environment. So in other
right.
words, there was no reason for those moods. They
exactly.
would just come at random. They would last for random periods of time, and there seemed to be no reason for them.
Right. Right.
At that type of, like, if I had a child like that, I might look for a mood disorder. On the
right.
other hand, and I'm not an expert in ADHD, I'll say that right off the top, but
okay.
In ADHD, my understanding is the symptoms are typically fairly consistent.
Yes.
And so you would see things like excessive talking, increased
yes.
distractibility, motor activity
yes.
on a fairly
mm-hmm.
consistent basis for someone
yes.
with ADHD. So
yes.
that would be the differentiating factor for me if
right.
I were looking at a child.
Right. And the other thing with ADHD that a lot of people are, young children are diagnosed with in adolescence is oppositional defiant disorder. And what I noticed, especially with kids and adolescents, that when I have a parent bring their child into me, what I normally do is bring the parents in and work on the family system, because many times what you're seeing there is the behavior is exhibited because of the dysfunction in the family and how everybody's interacting, everybody's communicating. And a lot of times for myself, when I work with these people, I can see those behaviors start to come down instead of right away to jump into medicating that. Because I think sometimes we tend to medicate behavior too much.
And I totally agree with you. I think medicating a child is your absolute last step. It's not your first step. And dealing with family dynamics is a first step, without a doubt, for me. You know, if it were up to me, no child would ever be medicated, you know, if I could make that rule. But, of course, we can't do that. Some children need medication, but it is a last resort, and it's not a first resort.
Right. And one of the things that I tell parents that come in to me and they want to talk about medication is, you know, my feeling is if your child's self-esteem is really, really suffering and you've run the gamut of other situations, for example, coaching or therapy or family work, and it still seems like the child, especially socially, is really struggling because, you know, they don't know, ADHD doesn't know space, and they get in your face, and they're talking all the time, or they're going to the extremes of trying to be funny when they're really not funny. They're looking kind of strange. At that point in time, my suggestion would be, just a suggestion, that they probably talk to a psychiatrist about what their thoughts would be to help the child's self-esteem. Because I think when a child's self-esteem is suffering, that can be really detrimental.
Yeah, and I would tend to agree with that. I mean, when it really starts to impact a child's social life, their life at school, the way they interact with other kids, the way they interact even with other adults, that really impacts how that person is going to grow up and how that person is going to mature. And so that's going to have a huge impact on them their entire life long. So certainly at that time, it is worth talking to a psychiatrist, absolutely.
Right, I agree. So let me talk to you a little bit about your journey through medication and how you got to this place where now you seem to be doing so incredibly well and are very successful.
Yeah, so it's certainly been a very long medication journey. When I was initially misdiagnosed with unipolar depression, of course, I was initially placed on an antidepressant. And antidepressants, of course, are contraindicated when they're used alone in bipolar disorder. So that tends to make you feel worse, in other words, if you get an antidepressant as monotherapy. And so for me, the antidepressants, what would happen would be it wouldn't make me feel better, and I would get every side effect listed on the package. That's what would happen. That's what would happen to me. So antidepressants would make me feel worse. And eventually, when I did get the correct diagnosis of bipolar disorder, and I would take mood stabilizers, and this, of course, was about 15 years ago, so we didn't have as many options as we have today for mood stabilization. We only really had three options at the time. And I took those medications, and those medications made me sick as well. I couldn't take enough of the medication to ever get a mood stabilizing effect out of it because I was so sensitive to the side effects. And at that point, actually, my doctor gave up. He dismissed me as a patient.
Wow.
He said, I can't help you, go away. So that was very hard,
obviously. But you were persistent, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, so at that time I was seeing a therapist. I'd been seeing a therapist all along. And so the therapist and I continued to work together after my doctor had dismissed me. And eventually I was in such a pronounced suicidal state that my therapist said to me, you absolutely have to go back to your psychiatrist. You absolutely have to get treated by him. You're going to die. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. I basically went back to my therapist, and I begged my therapist to treat me, and he did. And what he did was he tried a medication that at the time was not indicated for bipolar disorder. It was basically a guess that he was making.
Okay.
And it just so happened that that was a miracle for me and that that drug was amazing.
Wow. That's incredible. And how many years ago was that?
So that was probably about 12 years ago now.
Okay.
That medication was an absolute miracle for me at the time, and I credit that medication for allowing me to get through university to get a degree.
Okay.
But since then, I've had periods where that medication stopped working, and we've had to search for other medications, and then those medications have stopped working, and we've had to search for more medications. So I've been through probably 40 medications altogether, searching for combinations and cocktails that actually are sufficient with my bipolar disorder.
See, and I think what you're talking about right now is really important for people who are listening because, and again, I'm going to bring up my son. He's been struggling. He was diagnosed a year and a half ago, and he is in the struggle right now, as you describe, of really being able to find that cocktail of medications where he's feeling good and has motivation. You know, he's in and out of school because he gets depressed and the motivation goes away and he just can't continue. Although I do give him a lot of credit because he is embracing his bipolar. And a lot of it is because I raised both my boys to embrace their ADD instead of, being very negative about it and running away and not wanting to deal with it. And I think that's part of the reason why he's continuing to move forward. And I'm just so impressed that you continued that process because I can't really say this enough. There's so many people out there who give up after one or two tries.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I hear from people all the time who are 6 months into the process, for example, who are saying, I can't take this anymore. When is something going to work? I'm going to give up. And unfortunately, what I have to tell them is it takes on average 2 years for someone with bipolar disorder to get sufficiently medicated to a place where they regain their life. You can't give up after 6 months. That's not how it works. You have to give it time. And I don't like to throw out 2 years because it sounds like it's the rest of your life. I understand that.
Yeah.
But it could happen a lot sooner. It could happen a lot sooner for you. But the point is that you can't give up early because there are so many things that we can do. And what I tell people is that if they are in a situation where their doctor were to give up on them, that it is pretty much what I would consider to be malpractice to just give up on a patient and not do anything for them. And that doctor is absolutely wrong because there is an unending number of medications and combinations and therapies that we now use today that absolutely can help people.
And you know what, Natasha, I want to talk more about that, but I wanted to ask you, we have a caller on the line that would like to ask you a question. Would it be okay if I let the caller on and then we can continue?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Okay, hi, this is Justine Rutolo.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you? Who is this?
Oh, I'm doing great. My name's Christina D. Soden.
Hi, Christine. Did you have a question for Natasha?
Yeah, Natasha, my stepson, I feel, suffers from dissociative disorder, DAD, that. The problem is 2 years ago his father died of excessive pharmacology, and, I have a feeling that due to the sensitivity of the case of excessive pharmacology that shortened a lot of life expectancies with this alleged mental illness of misdiagnosed, could be a physical injury. I'm a little concerned. The only thing I could give his legal birth mother was, 21 to drink alcohol-containing beverages and don't drink and drive because allegedly she drinks beer within the household. And, I'm a little concerned that he might have an early demise report, like an autopsy at a young age, if given the stringent pharmacology list that I was given prior to St. Patrick's Day 2000 for a back injury.
So, and your question to
my
Natasha
question is, you know, with a dissociative disorder and the length of, like, for example, my stepson, we got a brand new refrigerator that the landlord bought us. He kept slamming the door over and over again, and I was just setting up my computer to continue my education. You know, very, very recommended in this day and age, in the new millennium, any
yes.
age. And he just kept slamming it over and over again, and my husband at the time, or fiancé, so I say, would just talk to him like a fire hydrant, you know, what are you doing, Zach? Stop doing that. And he just kept smiling at me, slamming the refrigerator door. I turned around and I talked to him like an adult, like most children, like I would when I was little, would rather be talked to than an idiot. And I said, listen,
okay.
Zach, that's not our refrigerator, and you can't afford to replace it if it's break. Could you stop slamming the door? And he stopped immediately and was not offended by the sternness of my voice.
Okay, so your question to Natasha is about medication for your stepson?
I could just give her a warning because this is a cycle in Suffolk County, Long Island. Apparently, if someone dies of pharmacology due to this mental illness, it's hearsay and they don't even know your name in the end, and there's no lawsuit and there's nobody even to call, even to backtrack, re-see if any side effects caused any type of pneumonia, aspiration, shortening of the breath. Very rarely is an autopsy done after the deceased, well under the age of 65, died due to pharmacology related to psychotropics that are given probably because of misdiagnosed. It might have been a physical injury and not a mental one, which this is what these doctors have been doing over and over and over again.
Natasha, are you there?
I'm Christina.
I know, I'm looking for Natasha. Are you there, Natasha? I think we might have lost Natasha.
Sure. Hi, I'm here.
Hi. So I'm sorry, I thought we lost you. So we have to get off now, Christina. Can you just tell us what the question is, because we need to go on with the show. Okay, I think she hung up, so let's just continue. I'm sorry. I really didn't understand. I don't know if you did, Natasha, what her question was.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what she was getting at there.
Yeah.
So I'm not familiar with the case or anything like that, so I can't really comment.
Right. Okay, so what we've been talking about really is hypomania. Can you discuss at all bipolar 1, which is, to me, the more severe form of bipolar, I guess you could say?
Sure. So first of all, to disagree, but bipolar 1 is not more severe.
Okay.
Bipolar 1 is just different. So
okay.
It's a pretty common misconception that it is more severe. It's not more severe. It's just that the symptomology is different. So
okay.
In bipolar 1, periods of mania are experienced, and periods of mania, by definition, are life-threatening. So it's very dangerous.
Okay.
And so
a
period of mania is a period of very elevated mood, and this could manifest itself as a euphoria, but it could also manifest itself as severe irritability.
Okay.
So some people enjoy parts of their mania because of how it makes them feel, whereas other people find it to be the worst feeling in the world because of how it manifests. And so it's very individual. And so people will experience the same symptoms as hypomania, but to a greater extent. So greater
and
talking.
And I think that's why when I went to graduate school, that's how it was explained to us. That it was because it was a greater form of mania, and the way it was described to us, as in the DSM, the depression was more severe. That's why I thought it was a little bit more severe than what my son is going through right now.
Yeah, so the depression is actually not more severe. The mania is, absolutely, but the depression is not more severe. And actually what we see is that people in bipolar 2 spend a lot more time depressed than people with bipolar 1.
Okay.
So people with bipolar 1 do have that life-threatening mania. Absolutely a problem. They can experience psychosis. It's very dangerous.
Right.
But they experience, statistically speaking, less depression. So it's just different.
Okay. And would you say that that population in the bipolar 1, would you say that that intense mania may be part of the reason why we see suicidal ideation and suicides?
No, actually. So what I would say is that the worst mood for suicides statistically is actually a mixed episode. And
okay.
It is most dangerous in bipolar 1 because a mixed episode is when you have symptoms of mania with symptoms of depression.
Okay.
And so the symptom of depression might be suicidal ideation, and the symptom of mania might be excessive energy. And unfortunately,
okay.
if you combine those two symptoms, you have
right.
someone who very readily may attempt to take their own life.
Right.
Whereas if you have a straight unipolar depression where the person has suicidal ideation, but they also have a massive lack of energy, they're actually less likely to attempt to take their own life in that state. So,
wow, that's great.
Episode,
that's a great explanation. I love that because
yeah.
I didn't understand that.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, that's really good. And so in your work that you do you work with people one-on-one with bipolar?
I sometimes do, yep.
Okay. And do you find what do you do with people that are bipolar? Like, how do you work with them?
So I would consider myself to be a coach, okay?
Okay.
So I don't have a clinical degree, I'll just say right
okay.
up front. I do
mm-hmm.
not have a clinical degree. So
okay.
what I am is someone who is a bit of a guide, a bit of a
okay.
sounding board.
You
know,
okay.
the problem with bipolar disorder is it often feels like you're stumbling around in the dark, and
okay.
there's no one there to turn on the light for you. Well, I turn on the light for people
That's
because
great.
Pretty much no matter where a person has been, I've been there before, and I have some sense of what the next step is that they need to take, because often that's what a person really needs to know is what's the next step. Because they're
right.
just not getting there on their own.
That's right. And that's an excellent point. And I'm sure anybody you work with is very lucky to have you in your life because of all the work that you've done on yourself is really transferred to them in so many ways. And that's just a wonderful thing. Natasha, we have a man on the line that would like to ask you a specific question. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. Hi, this is Justine Rotolo.
Hi, Justine. This is Steve.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good. Thank you, Natasha. I've just been listening for the last couple of minutes, and I have to say I'm very thankful for you taking your time to put all your energy into this show. My question specifically is I am bipolar disorder. I have bipolar disorder been diagnosed. I'm dual diagnosed with another diagnosis, which compounds the cocktails, but specifically, I'm working on, do you know anything about lithium, specifically low dosage therapy, where it's like 300 to 600 milligrams? And that's part one. And part two would be, opposed to the larger, I think it's 1800 or 1600 milligrams, when it controls the mania, will a low dosage eliminate. My fear is that I don't treat the mania because I don't want to give up on the brilliance. I also write. I also blog. I'm a recent SAMHSA fellowship winner. I work part-time. I'm disabled. I live on disability, of course, my bipolar disorder, but I'm one of those people like yourself. I'm a certified peer. I'm one of those people out there putting myself out there, but you know, at the same time, when I'm home writing and blogging and doing all my stuff, I'm still struggling. You know, it's not like my recovery is like 100%. And so my therapists and a plethora of them, because before Obamacare, you know, when you're on disability, you didn't really have that kind of insurance. And now I have it. Now I have full long-term chronic mental health care, and I'm so looking forward to it. But so let me focus. And so the questions are low therapy, low dosage therapy for lithium. Do you have any experience or insight on that? And then if you go with a low dosage, how does that affect with squashing your memory? Not your memory, your creativity.
Yeah, so my first thing I'd like to say about medications and creativity, which is that I've said this publicly before, if your medication is squashing your creativity, then it's not the right medication for you.
That's right.
Because you do not have to pay for your medication with a loss of parts of who you are. You don't have to do that. That's not a trade you have to make. So if you want to look at low-dosage therapy with lithium, that's perfectly acceptable. I do know people who take that, and I know that it's very successful for them. You know, there's a therapeutic range that we know of with lithium that they use to, they measure your blood level. So your blood level of lithium has to be within a certain range in order for it to be considered therapeutic. But the thing is, everyone is different, and sometimes it doesn't have to be in that range for someone to find it therapeutically beneficial. So my advice in that particular case is, you know, obviously start with a very low dose and work up to a range that you feel comfortable with, whatever that is, and make an assessment for yourself, because everyone is so individual. For myself, I was on a very, very low dose of an antipsychotic to the point where my doctor said, well, that shouldn't be doing anything, so we'll just take you off of it. And when we did, I became destabilized, and because I'm just so sensitive. So it's really an individual thing, and you have to give it a try to really find out if it works for you.
Oh, I appreciate that very much. I don't want to hold it up because I'm sure there's other callers, but my psychiatrist and I are new because I've been, you know, dashing other ones because I felt like the pharmaceutical reps keep pushing this on me, and I'm like, finally I have someone that's just like, you know, well, you know, it's sort of what you just said, and yet I just one additional question to that is, in trial and error, obviously with all these meds up, because I've been through many of them, you know, all kinds of side effects, and obviously you come off of them and everything resets back. Same kind of thing, right? Lithium, I mean, I'm so afraid that it's just going to, like, alter my, you know, artistic creativity that if I even try it and I go come off of it, I'm going to be like, it's going to open up another doorway of some other dimension of illness. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me. I think fear of medication is a very real fear. Like, that's real and needs to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. But I think that we have to, you know, have rational fears and irrational fears. And a rational fear is, what's going to happen to me when I take this medication? That's a completely rational fear. But, for example, is this going to open up a new dimension of illness when I get off of it? That's probably an irrational fear because we have no evidence to suggest that that would ever happen. If you got off the lithium, you'd be exactly at the place where you were before you started the lithium, most likely. That's what we would likely see. So your fear is real, absolutely, but I would just use a certain amount of logic on top of it to determine what part of the fear is really rational.
Okay. I appreciate your time. Thank you very, very much, and I'll be sure to listen in the future, and both of you and everyone on the show, producers and so forth. Have a good New Year.
Thank you,
Steve. Thanks for calling in. Bye. Yeah, that's a question that I get a lot in the world of ADHD. When medication is added, and sometimes for those of us who are the inattentive type, who don't have the hyper and impulsivity, it seems like when they get on those meds, they kind of lose their personality, and some of their creativity, because they're very creative, seems to disappear. So I agree with you in when it takes away your personality completely or your creativity kind of drops off, that the meds aren't right.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think there's two parts to that. That's what I've said, and I absolutely think that, but I also think that people need to be on medication for a certain amount of time in order to assess where their creativity is. Because I do think that you may have a different thought process on medication, but that's why you're on the medication. You're on that medication to make your thought processes to some degree change. And it takes some time to actually get used to the way you feel on a medication. And
right.
So you can't just take a medication and in, you know, 4 weeks say, no, this has hampered my ability to paint and I'm going off of it. It may take you 8 weeks to actually determine, no, I'm actually okay with this and I can work with this and I have new ways to be creative. Because we
right.
find new ways to be creative. It's,
no,
it's,
you're right.
You know, it may change you, but it doesn't necessarily, it's not going to decimate you. It,
right.
it may
except,
change the way you are.
Except in the world of ADD, when you go on a stimulant, it's very quick. I mean,
yeah,
I will never forget, I'm not on stimulants anymore. But the first time I ever went on one, I cried because it was, even though I had gone to college, it was the first time I could read something and retain it. Because my mind was wandering so much all the time. Excuse me, I couldn't focus enough to read and retain. So it happened very quickly for me. So I think in the world of antidepressants or mood stabilizers, that may take a little bit more time. But with the stimulant, you pretty much can tell pretty quickly, how is this affecting me? And you can play with the dosage. You can titrate up and down to see if that works. But I think across the board, and I see this a lot with, again, I'm going to say with the inattentive type, where it kind of just sometimes wipes out the personality, just makes them so flat that they're not communicating effectively either. So
yeah, and you never want to see that. I mean, some people are zombified by
yes,
medication,
yes.
and that is something that you never want to see.
No, and I agree with that. And we do have another woman with a question, if you don't mind. So we'll bring her on. Okay. Is she on the phone, honey?
Yeah, I am.
Hi.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Hey, Natasha, this is Carrie Martin calling. I just wanted to say first that it is so amazingly incredible to have someone with your intelligence and how well you articulate what's going on in the bipolar community. I mean, you're just an amazing representative for us. As someone who is also bipolar, I was curious. You work with a lot of bipolar people, and you do a lot of research and a lot of writing. If you had to pick one issue which the bipolar community has that you see is not being addressed right now, what do you think that would be? In other words, what is the greatest need in that community?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Thank you for
yeah,
calling.
Really is.
Yeah, that is excellent. I think if there's one thing that we see in the bipolar community that is the scariest, it's, well, two things. One is misdiagnosis, and two is incorrect treatment. And this treatment is typically given by GPs. And I don't want to disrespect a general practitioner doctor because those people are wonderful at what they do and they're very important. But unfortunately, people with general knowledge of health, which is what a general practitioner has,
right.
is simply not qualified to treat a mental illness. A mental illness is a specific illness that needs a specialist. It requires a specialist. And unfortunately, what we see is GPs doing the diagnosing and the treating and them doing it quite poorly. And because of this, it can take 10 years on average for a person with bipolar disorder to get the correct diagnosis. People are treated for years and years incorrectly, and this just makes people worse. And so if I had one piece of knowledge that I could give the world, it would be GPs need to do a better job of looking for hypomania, because they clearly aren't doing it now. And they need to take seriously the recommendations from places like the International Bipolar Foundation that came out with some recommendations regarding antidepressant use in bipolar disorder and how contraindicated antidepressants are as monotherapy in bipolar disorder. And I would say to GPs, you absolutely have to take that stuff seriously because right now they're hurting the population.
Yeah,
yeah
that's a very good point.
Yeah, I would Yeah, I would agree. I think, too, however, that it's parents we need to be talking to, because it's parents who are taking their kids to a GP and allowing a GP, for example, to give an 8-year-old an antidepressant as a test
yes.
to see if they're bipolar or ADHD. And I have an issue, with that. I think parents need to be educated so they know when a GP says, oh, we're going to give your kid an antidepressant for a couple of weeks, then take him off and see what happens to him. Parents are knowledgeable enough to say, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And then go and seek, you know, more expert advice.
And, you,
parents
and if
really
I can
have to advocate for their kids.
If I can add something to that as well, being, you know, an ADHD coach for 21 years, I'm also a marriage and family therapist. What I notice with parents, and this is so unfortunate, is their GPs are covered or their pediatricians are covered under insurance. And so when they come to me and I find out the pediatricians are medicating with not only the ADD meds, the stimulants, but as you said, you know, mood stabilizers or antidepressants, you know, I encourage them to see psychiatrists, and many, many times insurance doesn't completely cover that. And
yes.
that, hopefully, with Obamacare may change that situation, because I think that that becomes a financial issue, too, because I don't know about you, but in Southern California, in Los Angeles, I mean, the initial visit with a psychiatrist can be upwards of $600.
Yeah.
Right.
That's
right.
a lot of money. Yeah.
And the other issue, too, is, you know, with a psychiatrist, you know, an MD who can prescribe medication versus a PhD, you know, a lot of them are on this sort of clock where they have like 15 minutes for your
right.
Medicine management. And so basically when I went in at 43 and 47, I was diagnosed as bipolar after being treated for manic depressive for 20 years and given incorrectly antidepressants in about 5 minutes. And I hear about that a lot, where people say they go into a doctor and a doctor, you know, in 5 to 10 minutes, because, oh, my goodness, yes, you're bipolar, and then start you on medication. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. It is ridiculous. Bipolar is a very serious condition, and it's like any other serious condition. You certainly shouldn't be giving it such short shrift that you just make that kind of diagnosis over, you know, the course of a few minutes. And I fully appreciate the financial burden that people like parents
right.
face when it comes to dealing with mental health. I do fully appreciate that. And I believe in working with the system as it exists in the best way that we can in
yeah.
order to try to make it work for people, because we don't live in a perfect land. We never
no.
will.
No.
So
no.
we do have to work with the system as it is. But, yeah, we need to have a better education on all levels so that patients can demand a better service than that. They can say,
exactly.
you know, it's only been 10 minutes. How could you possibly be diagnosing me with this? I need
right.
a longer
right.
appointment. I need an evaluation appointment. You know, I
right.
need something
right.
more appropriate. I need a more appropriate care. Because certainly you don't want to be stuck with that label when it's inappropriate either.
Exactly.
Well, I think, too, yeah, with people like you, Natasha, standing up and educating not only parents but also, you know, people, individuals, to be their own mental health advocates, it's because of people like you that people are going to have the chutzpah to say, wait a minute, you can't tell me that after 5 minutes, you know?
Right.
So I want to, again, make sure that you realize how much I, as a bipolar person and someone who works with the bipolar community, appreciate everything you do and what an amazing advocate you are for us.
Thank you so
That's
much.
Great.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Thank
okay.
you. Thank you
Thank
for
you
calling.
Thank you so much for answering my questions. Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. So I wanted to talk a little bit about ADHD and bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are many times that, especially with the ADHD and the, you know, the hyperactive and the severe impulsivity, there are times when I think bipolar can be missed. And I myself see it in the practice with, you know, some of my clients that come in. And I have one recently in particular who went to a psychiatrist, and unfortunately the psychiatrist said to him, what would you like?
Yeah.
And
I hate that.
So, I know. And
yeah.
so he said, well, I'd like some Adderall. So he put him on some Adderall. And what I noticed when he came in is that he was a lot hyper, talking very fast. And I said, are you on the Adderall? And he said, yes, I am. And so I started to ask him some questions about, you know, his mood and, you know, was he feeling himself getting down, or was he, as you said before, because I think many times in that world of dysthymic disorder, I know for myself, when I was depressed years ago, it manifested itself in low frustration tolerance, getting very angry very quickly. And, you know, he was saying yes to some of these things. And what I was noticing, because he's also a member of my adult group that I run for ADD for Chad in Los Angeles area, he would come sometimes and sit all the way in the back of the room and look very sad, very sad. And I just mentioned to him that I thought maybe he needed to do some more research for another psychiatrist. Of course, I had some names, but they were also very expensive.
Yeah.
And he was going to keep doing that because my feeling is we were dealing with something else. And that's, you know, something I wanted to talk about, because you can have the comorbidity of, you know, ADHD and bipolar, and you can have depression and anxiety. But I think sometimes it can be difficult to diagnose because it might kind of fly under the radar. We may miss something. So do you see this in your own practice, or you know, in your work with people with bipolar?
Yeah, you know, so there's a study, and I can give you, it's called the Comorbidity of Adult Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder in Bipolar Patients. So
okay.
There's a study there, and what they found is that 23.3% of adults with bipolar disorder also had adult ADHD.
Okay.
That's what that particular study found. So we're talking about almost one in four. So
right.
That's a huge number of people who
yes.
have comorbid ADHD and bipolar disorder. So it is, from my experience, it is difficult to tell the difference in some situations, especially in children. But, you know, when those two things manifest together, you know, it really does make it very complicated for service providers. And, you know, often they don't know where to start. Do you start with treating the bipolar? Do you start with treating the ADHD? I mean, where
exactly.
do you start? What medications do you give? The medication
right.
that might make ADHD better might make the bipolar worse.
Exactly.
So how do you start? What do you know? And, you know, and the other thing that happens is patients aren't even told of their comorbidities. You know,
oh, yeah.
in their file somewhere, it might say patient also exhibits ADHD, but the patient is never even told that. They're just told that they have bipolar disorder. And when they have these other things happening to them that don't fit into that disorder but do fit into ADHD, they don't even know what's happening because no one's
right.
been told them.
And, you know, and a big part of that, Natasha, too, is I feel sometimes like they're spoken to like they really don't know what they're talking about, and just trust me. You know, you get that feeling like,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
trust me, I can handle this. Well, you know, it's similar but not the same for me when I go into school for kids and adolescents with parents for 504 plans and IEPs. The schools at times will be very rude to the parents until I come in, and then it kind of looks a little differently because, oh, there's somebody here that knows. It's really unfair because it's like this is – everybody needs to take hold of their own life, their own mental disorders, their own neurological disorders, and there needs to be that respect from the MD community or the therapist community or the school systems for these people that they are learning. They're really trying to know a lot about themselves, as you did. As I did when I was diagnosed at 41 with ADHD, but not everybody has those tools to get there as quickly. And I think it can actually stop some people from going in and looking for help for fear that they're going to feel criticized.
Yep. You feel criticized, you feel belittled, you feel small, you feel scared. All these things happen often when you're talking to a doctor. Some doctors understand this. Some doctors absolutely don't.
Right.
You know, a doctor is a person in a position of authority, and some people handle people in positions of authority well. Some people don't.
And some doctors really believe in paternal doctoring, i.e. exactly what you said, which is that I'll just handle this. You're just the patient. I know what I'm doing. You just do what I tell you to do. And, of course, that's not the model that I believe in.
No.
I believe
and I don't either.
Yeah, I believe that your patient and doctor, work together.
So we now have a man on the line who's from the United Kingdom. And he would like to speak to you. So we're going to get him on the line right now. Okay, hi. This is Justine Rotolo.
Hi. My name is Jamal. And
how are you? You have a question for Natasha?
I'm fine, thank you. It's everything, really. And I was just interested to hear what you were saying about general practitioners and how they deal with mental health disorders. I'm 45, and I was only diagnosed last year with personality disorder, with borderline personality disorder. And just how that can some of the traits of personality disorder can actually be. I know you've been talking about bipolar disorder and ADHD, but the connections between borderline personality disorder and bipolar and also ADHD. And I know things are very, very different. As how they're understood between the US and between the UK. But there's, you know, it is very much that there is a crossover between traits, between certain things, and how mental health is an absolute minefield. And for GPs who, general practitioners, who say, oh, well, this, and this, and how people do go misdiagnosed. I did hear very briefly, you talk about misdiagnosis.
Yes. Yes, they do.
And how important that can be. I actually have my own show on a Saturday afternoon.
Oh, great.
Here in the UK on Blog Talk Radio. So I wanted to get involved because I was made aware of this show.
Okay, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for calling in. And Natasha, maybe you can speak to him a little bit about, because I do know that personality disorders can be diagnosed with ADHD and bipolar, and so maybe you want to address that with him a little bit.
Yeah, so bipolar disorder and borderline personality disorder are two completely different disorders. Sometimes people conflate the two. And they're actually considered different types of disorders because bipolar disorder is a mood disorder, whereas borderline is a personality disorder. So it's just important to understand the difference between the two. And so, but what is interesting, and I've done a little research on this, and it turns out that borderline personality disorder is actually comorbid, so it exists alongside bipolar disorder in around 40% of cases. A huge number of people actually suffer from borderline and bipolar disorder together. So making a diagnosis one over the other or both is actually very difficult for practitioners. You know, there's some of the symptoms that you see in borderline are things like a frantic effort to avoid real or imagined abandonment, impulsivity, which of course you might see in bipolar disorder, recurrent suicidal behavior, which you might see in bipolar disorder. So it's a very challenging area of study, and something that can be very difficult to deal with.
Definitely, and it's something that I'm very, very passionate about identifying between the two. And it is very difficult for a general practitioner to decipher between the two. Unless you undertake specific tests that there is a distinction between the two. And something I covered in one of my shows recently was not just the bipolar, but the ADHD,
Yes.
That in childhood, somebody can be perceived as being ADHD.
Yeah.
But it has been proven that that can actually develop into either bipolar or very much so into borderline personality disorder. And the connection between all three, I know you're talking about bipolar and ADHD, particularly tonight.
Yes.
But I just wanted to call because of my own diagnosis and the connection between all three.
Yes.
And how difficult it is for a practitioner to actually,
right.
or a general practitioner, to distinguish between all three, depending on
and
your
I,
age.
And I will tell you that even as a therapist, it's difficult to distinguish between the three. You know, borderline personality disorder is also very close to narcissistic personality disorder, so you can have an overlap. So it's a very intricate diagnosis, and as Natasha was speaking about before, you have to be very careful in labeling people with something that may not really be true. And so there are experts. I know in my field there are experts that deal in the world of personality disorders. And then
yes.
there are experts that deal in ADHD, and, you know, there are experts that deal in bipolar and depression. So, you know, I myself, as a therapist, at times I may have somebody that comes in and we may not really be able to decipher exactly what's going on, so I will always refer them out. I have a list of professionals that I refer to that are experts in different areas. You know, people that have severe anxiety issues also.
Absolutely.
They need to be referred out too. So, you know, to just be going to a general practitioner who, and excuse me if I misunderstood you, but you're saying this isn't even a therapist. Is that correct?
It's actually, well, from my own experience of a general practitioner who struggles to experience certain aspects of it. I mean, I do have to say I've worked in mental health myself for 13 years.
Okay.
With all aspects of mental health, and with my own diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, I've been able to mask. I've become a very, very good actor.
Okay.
you laugh there, so you probably come across that yourself.
Well, because you know what I believe in? I love to laugh about things because I think that, yes, mental disorders are serious, but there's always got to be that time where we find humor in everything, because I think it can be very helpful in us getting better also. And so,
I agree with that too.
Yes. I've met borderline personality disorders who, you know, they're actors. Yes, many of them are actors. And, you know, they come to therapy to mimic emotion. They don't really come to therapy because they are totally, most of them are not self-aware. And I am I'm a big person on self-awareness because I believe it's the first step in getting better. If we're aware of our behaviors and how they affect others, we can really start that change process. So that's why I kind of chuckled, because the acting thing is funny. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and for myself personally,
yes.
I think I speak for a lot of people that I've come across myself in the work that I've done previously.
Yes.
With borderline personality, there is an element of acting, but the element of the emotion that you experience is very much real for you.
Oh yeah.
And you react to that. You react to that emotion, and to a lot of people, it seems like an overreaction. So you tend to adapt your behaviour, and there is an element of manipulation. I have to say, with BPD, there is an element of manipulation, because. But again, that self awareness that you mentioned is. A lot of people with BPD do have a lot of self-awareness, and it is that self-awareness that allows them to manipulate the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't done in a malicious way. it's done in a way of protection.
That's exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. And yeah. And I really struggle with that myself, and it's a major issue with relationships. And
yes.
one of my most recent relationships was with somebody who I explained that my new diagnosis and that all these things that I was very much aware of through my professional life, and I acknowledged a lot of these traits in myself, and I tried to explain this to an ex-partner of mine who was, I have experience of this and this, and I tried to explain that this is something that you probably never experienced. Because personality disorders, you know, and as you probably will admit yourself, that we all have a personality, and everybody's personality is disordered.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, and it only becomes a personality disorder when it kind of impacts on your daily living and how it
That's
impacts
exactly
on
right.
how you live your daily life.
Yeah.
And I'm seen as being very articulate, and I can do this, and it's very frustrating for myself, because in my professional life, I can deal with all the emotional baggage that people have, and all the difficulties, and I can point them in the right direction. But when I'm presented with the same situation myself in my own personal life, as much as I have all the knowledge and all the experience and where I need to go and what I need to do, it all goes out the window. And I can't deal with it myself.
Yeah.
And I've spoken to people with personality disorder who have said to me, and somebody I work with very closely, very recently, who just prior to my own diagnosis, he said to me, "Do you understand me better than anybody else? Do you have a PD?"
Wow.
And I said, "Maybe I do, but I'm undiagnosed."
Yeah. Right.
And it actually took, I've dealt with this for like 30 odd years, 30 plus
wow.
years.
Wow.
And again, that's when I talk about being a very good actor, that I've convinced people that there's nothing wrong because the professionals wouldn't listen to me.
Yeah.
Because I could only present to them when I was well. And I have a friend with me at the moment who I worked with many, many years ago, who, when I told him about it, said, "I would have never have known that you had daily suicidal ideation, that you had this, you felt this, you thought this." Because I was very good at hiding it, I became a very, very good actor.
Yeah.
And I could deal with those really, really sensitive issues with somebody else, but at the same time, experiencing the same things. And it took me until my 44th year for me to actually act upon the suicidal ideation, where I took a significant overdose.
Wow.
And I died twice within a week, and then was admitted for a week into a psychiatric unit. Which was quite a surreal experience for myself, because I'd always been on the other side. I'd worked on the wards, I'd worked in psychiatric units, I'd always been the professional, and suddenly I was on the other side of the wall.
Yeah, it's frightening.
It was very, very frightening. It was a realization that actually, my head messed up.
Yeah.
I'd always been able to mask it.
I think your ability to work with others with that, it's just like Natasha with bipolar and me with ADHD. I really believe that the true experts in these fields are people who experience this daily, because we know what it's like to get up and to walk through our day in this way.
Exactly.
And other people
do
not. And, you know, I'm not saying that there are other people out there who are experts in the field and don't struggle with this, and I'm sure they're very good at what they do, but they don't live this every single day like we do.
Yep.
And so, you know, I'm going to have to, we're going to have to hang up because we have three other callers. Natasha is so popular. This is just unbelievable. So I really thank you so much for calling. And, you know, I personally would love to talk to you again sometime. If you want to contact me, that would be great.
That would be great. Do you have any contact details I can contact you on? I know I can contact Natasha. I would love to have either Natasha or yourself on future shows I do.
Yes, that would be great. And you know what? You can contact me, as I'm sure Natasha as well, on Facebook. My Facebook page is Miss, M-I-S-S-A-D-D.
I will look you up very soon.
Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
And you too.
Take care.
Thanks. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, Natasha, we now have a gentleman who has two questions for you, if that's okay.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Hi, this is Justine Rotolo.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. This is Justine Rotolo. Who am I speaking with?
Oh, hi. My name is Jared.
Hi. Did you have a question for Natasha?
I actually have a question for both of you.
Okay.
You were talking about labeling earlier,
mm-hmm.
and also
yes.
How you have to sometimes laugh about, you know, situations that you deal with.
Yes.
Do you find it offensive, Natasha, when someone says something like they describe themselves as being bipolar when they're not really bipolar? They're just saying, oh, I changed my mind, or, you know. And also, Justine, do you find it offensive when someone describes themselves as, you know, making an offhand comment saying, oh, wow, I'm so ADD, just because they, you know, cleaned up something or something, you know?
I don't. I can't answer for Natasha. I don't. I think it's really funny because I look at ADD as a gift. So, you know, we're just so creative and we're great people. We're out-of-the-box thinkers. I personally don't. Do you, Natasha?
Yeah, so I don't find it offensive either. To me, so I'm a writer. That's what I do, you know, a lot of. And to me, language words are just used to describe things. And so a person can say, you know, oh, I'm feeling really bipolar today, or the weather's really bipolar today, or whatever. And it's just a word. It's just a descriptor.
I like that.
I don't find that to be insulting at all. They're just using a word in the English language. To me, there's no insult there. There's no intention
right.
to harm. So to
right.
me, there's no insult.
Right. I agree. And that's a great way to put it, too. Does that answer your question?
It does, yeah.
Okay. Did you have another question for us?
No, I actually only had one.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling. We really appreciate it. Okay, so now we have someone else on the phone that has a question. Hi, this is Justine Rotolo.
Yes, hi. This is Chris.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you? Did you have a question for Natasha?
I do, actually, and I've actually spoken with Natasha before. Natasha, you may remember I had some questions with you or for you about doing a blog, and we actually did a Skype session at one point, but maybe you do a lot of those and don't remember. But in any event, what my question is that I've been in to see a GP, and I do have bipolar, and the biggest problem that I had dealing with was more on the hypomaniac side, and so I was prescribed Xanax. But lately, I've been having a lot more depressive episodes, and Xanax obviously doesn't really do much for that. And I don't really know where to go. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions. Now, obviously, I would talk them over with my doctor and whatnot, but...
The best advice I have ever heard from someone who specializes in bipolar disorder, and his name is Jim Phelps, Dr. Jim Phelps. He runs a site called psycheducation.org. And the best advice I ever heard was stop the cycling first. So when you go with someone who has bipolar disorder and you're looking to treat them, stop the cycling first. That means get the person on a mood stabilizer so that their mood is stable. Once their mood is stable, so you're not going up and down anymore, then you can address the lingering mood issues. So a mood stabilizer might be the perfect thing for you to address both the hypomania and the depression. It might just work for you that way. Or it may be the case that once you're on a mood stabilizer, they stabilize your mood and they find that you still have some depressive symptoms and they may have to add an additional medication. That's also possible. But, yeah, the best advice I ever heard is stop the cycling, because when you cycle up and down like that, you tend to see patients get worse over time. Mm-hmm. So that's something that you really want to stop.
Yeah, and that's what I've been having a fair amount of trouble with is the cycling, so which hasn't really been stopped. I don't really have any experience with mood stabilizers and side effects. I tend to be sensitive to medicine too, so I'm a bit nervous about that. But what is your opinion, I guess, do you have any experience with mood stabilizers? Are there a lot of side effects of those, or are they fairly?
So it would depend on your doctor as to which mood stabilizer they pick first for you. Mm-hmm. So what we typically see for bipolar disorder is a doctor will either choose lithium or Depakote. Generally, they'll choose one of those two medications as a first-line medication for treating bipolar disorder. But, of course, it all varies by individual. Now,
right.
Lithium can be an absolute wonder drug for some people. And I know some people that are on lithium and have successfully been on it for decades, and it absolutely works for them. For other people, it's an absolute nightmare. They take it, and there are so many side effects that they can't tolerate it. And unfortunately, that's kind of what you're going to see with a lot of medications. Like with Depakote, for example, it can be a great medication. On the other hand, there's a rash that they're really concerned about with Depakote. And so if you were to get that rash, then that would absolutely be the wrong medication for you. So each
right.
medication has those pluses and minuses. And the best thing for you to do is when you talk with your doctor about the medication options for you is to then go and look up that medication on a site like rxlist.com, because a site like that will actually list the full prescribing information for the drug, it's called, and that will actually give you all of the side effects and how often those side effects occur, so that you can get an idea of what is most likely to occur, what's really unlikely to occur, and you can discuss that with your doctor.
Can I add something, if you don't mind?
Oh, please.
My son is also hypomania. I was talking about that before, Natasha, and the drug that he's on for mood stabilization is Lamictal, and
yep, that's another
he's
one.
Had
yep.
absolutely no side effects with that, and he, like yourself, is very sensitive to medication. So that might be something you just want to look up to see,
okay.
you know, if that's something you want to talk to your doctor about as well.
That is another prominent option for sure.
Yes, yeah.
All right. Well, that's excellent. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much for calling.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, Natasha, we have another one, okay?
Okay.
Hang on one minute. Hi, this is Justine Rotolo.
Hello, Justine. I'm just calling with a question for Natasha.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Now, Natasha, I had spoke with you before. This is Nick Sims. I spoke with you a long time ago. About a year ago, really. My daughter was diagnosed with bipolar. And now one thing that we notice is she doesn't have the same drive that she did before the diagnosis. And it's kind of hard to differentiate how much of that is from being a teenager and how much of that is the actual medicine or the condition. Do you have any advice you can lend?
Yeah, so is she successfully being medicated right now, would you say?
Yes, and also she just completed her first semester at college, you know, which was real impressive for us. I mean, that's encouraging. But it's still to the point where we still have to take so many steps beyond what you would expect at this level of maturity she should be at.
Yeah, so it is possible sometimes when we get a severe disorder, particularly when we're young, that it can halt maturity in other areas. Because the thing is, a person with a severe disorder at a young age is so busy dealing with that disorder, they haven't had a chance to deal with all of the other things that a person would normally deal with that would help their maturity. And as you identified, something like motivation can be affected by the disorder or the treatment. It can absolutely be either one of those things. So it can be tricky to figure out which one of those things or just part of the personality. It can be any of those things. So for something like motivation, my first thought would be if she's successfully being medicated and things are going well for her right now in that regard, my first thought would be, well, maybe some therapy would be in order, because motivation is such a personal thing, and it's so wrapped up with so many parts of a personality that I would think that it might take quite a bit of work to actually unravel what's going on for her in terms of motivation. So for a successfully medicated person, that would be my first suggestion.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Natasha. I appreciate it.
Thanks
for calling
in.
All right, bye.
So, Natasha, we now have another. We have Sue on the line for with a question with Natasha. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Natasha.
This is Justine Anderson, and
I am. I actually see you online quite often. And one of the questions that I have is in regards to misdiagnosis. I was diagnosed in my 40s with ADD. And then a reaction to one of the medications that I was put on and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which years later turned out to be a misdiagnosis, and I have learned that I also have anxiety disorder. And so one of the things that I also work as a certified peer specialist and as a certified rapid facilitator, mm-hmm. and in working with people, I've wondered about this myself, but I haven't actually come to a concrete grasp, and I'm wondering if you might be able to help with that. What do you tell somebody who, when they're diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and part of that criteria is questioning their disorder, is one of the symptoms of the disorder? How do you get around that?
Yeah, so like a person who may not believe that they have a disorder, for example?
Correct.
Yeah, so what you're talking about has a clinical name of anosognosia. Don't worry, I won't make you spell it. And so that is actually a clinical inability to recognize one's own illness. And we see that a lot in schizophrenia, but it can happen in any illness, and it can certainly happen in bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the ways that I would approach it, because I'm a very logic-centered person, I would try to take the emotion out of it, because we're all very emotional about our diagnosis, which is completely natural, and
right.
try to approach things from a logical fashion, which is, let's take a look at what your behavior is, what your emotions are, and what effect that's having on your life. So
right.
a very simple A to B to C type of discussion that tries to say, you know, okay, you went on a spending spree and you bought $10,000 handbags. So that's very unusual for you, and it's really harming you because you can't afford to pay for them. What do you think caused that? That's the kind of approach I personally would take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like in my instance, I had asked those questions, and it wasn't, and there was a counselor that I worked with towards the end there, who actually didn't believe that I had bipolar disorder either, and it took going to a different psychiatrist and whatnot, and actually getting a concrete diagnosis of you have ADD and you have anxiety. I don't see you as having bipolar disorder at all. But all of the time that I had questioned it before, the fact that I was questioning it was,
seen as a symptom is what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I can understand how incredibly frustrating that must have been for you, that the very fact that you're questioning your disorder seems to suggest that you have a disorder.
Exactly.
I can understand that would be very, very frustrating for a person, for sure. But I do think, you know, doctors make mistakes, and we do have to question them. That's part of our job as patients, is to say, okay, you think I'm bipolar. Now, what is your evidence to actually make that assessment of me? Because they need to have that. It has to be, this doctor feels that you're bipolar because of the following reasons. They don't get to just make that up for no reason. So, you know, just questioning is something that everyone as patient advocates needs to say is a good thing. Questioning is good. But, you know, if the doctor were able to give you significant reasons why they felt you were bipolar, you could then either dispute that and say, no, I don't agree with you. You know, that didn't happen the way you're suggesting that it did. That would give you an opportunity to actually speak with them on a level playing field rather than someone holding the card of diagnosis and holding it in some kind of shroud of secrecy, because that's not working for anyone. So,
right.
You know, that questioning, that what you were doing is a very tough thing, because sometimes it does indicate a disorder, but it might also just be that someone is being a really strong patient advocate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know the interesting thing when I had gone off, when I ended up going off the bipolar medication altogether, I, you know, had gotten to the last of the medications that I was able to use. And, you know, had an instance where I had some really bad side effects to the point where I thought I was going to end up in assisted living. And when I went off the medication, you know, I had talked to the doctor about everything. And he said, you know, if you really do have bipolar disorder, we'll know it pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know? Because, you know, he said, go ahead and stop taking it. And if you do have it, we'll know quick. And I didn't have, you know, I was actually a lot better off after going off of the medication than I had been in years.
Well, I'm very sorry you went through that. That's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in helping other people, you know, I don't want anybody else to have to experience that, you know, that fear of questioning, is this something that I really have? And having that, you know, somebody say, you know, hey, I'm the doctor. I hope
yeah,
the credentials.
Yeah. The,
you know what I'm saying?
I'm the
know
doctor
I'm
is
about.
Never a sufficient reason.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
No, it's
yeah.
not. No. No. Thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. So, you know, Natasha, we're going to have you and I are going to work out another time for you to be back on my show, because hands down, you have been the most popular person I've had on the show. Everybody's been calling in, and so you and I really did not get an opportunity to talk about the other things that we wanted to, but I'm so happy that people were calling in and you were here to answer questions for them. That was just, you know, incredible. Would you be willing to come back?
Of course. You know, I just want to say, you know, the reason why people are calling in is because I have the best readers in the world. So
yes. Yes.
I just
yeah.
want to say thanks very much to everybody for doing that. That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, and I have to tell you that what really attracted me to you was your bipolar burple, and it's really helped me tremendously in reading what you write about bipolar in terms of, you know, dealing with my son. And before we sign off, what I'd really like to talk about just for a few minutes is the effect that a person with bipolar in the family system can have on the rest of the family, and not necessarily in your specific family, but with people that you work with. How do you see that as affecting the family?
It's so, so tough, because when you have one person with a severe illness like bipolar disorder, it does change the whole family dynamic, because so much effort is often put on trying to help that one person help their wellness. So, like,
right.
One of two things either happens. Either the family unit exists to try and make that person well, and we often see that with children, where the whole family unit starts to, you know, every move that they make is dictated to try and make their child well again. Or what we see in sometimes in adults is the whole family turns away from the individual
right.
with bipolar disorder and just says, you know, be gone with you, we don't
right.
believe
right.
you, we don't want to help you, whatever.
Right.
So
right.
the family unit often goes one of those two ways. And in everything, I would, you know, suggest balance. You can't have a family unit that's dedicated
right.
to only one person.
And
that's
right.
certainly there should never be a family unit that completely ostracizes a person for just a medical illness.
Exactly. And one of the things that I've learned, because initially what started out before the diagnosis, my son was drinking a lot. And so, of course, I went to Al-Anon to learn a lot about being able to, you know, separate, and they call it detach with love, because we
yep.
are very enmeshed. But what I've discovered now, too, is that what he's looking for, and I want everybody who's listening to hear this, is he's looking for me to believe in him, that, you know, that I trust you. I trust that you're handling this. You're 26. You're doing a great job. And sometimes that can be difficult because we see things that they're doing that we may not agree with, but we just have to sit and watch the whole process as it unfolds. And, of course, if they're in trouble, like, you know, with suicidal ideation, or, you know, they're physically not doing well, or they need a therapist, or they need help there, and they ask for it, that's a completely different thing. But really trying to control the mental illness in somebody else, as you just said before, is not good, especially from a parent to a child as they get older.
Yeah. Once a person is adult, as an adult, they need to manage their illness in the best way that they can. You
exactly
you cannot
right.
control an adult with a mental illness. You just can't do it. And you do have to learn that even though someone with a mental illness maybe isn't handling it in the way that you would,
right.
unfortunately,
right.
you can't, you know, there's nothing you can do about that.
No.
You have
no.
to accept that they're an adult and they're living their life.
I agree. And again, I want to thank you so much for the time that you spent with us today, and I'm sure everybody who is listening and called in, they so appreciate you, and I do too. So I'm going to be in touch so we can set up another date for you to be back on the show so we can do some more of this, because this was wonderful.
In the meantime, anyone can find me at natashatracy.com.
Okay.
So people can find me there, and there's a contact form there if people want to contact me individually. You know, I'm happy to talk to people. So, yeah, go and take a look at my writings and take a look at my work, and hopefully that will help give a bit of insight about bipolar disorder. And, yes, I'm happy to come on the show again. No problem.
Great. Thank you so much, Natasha. I really appreciate all you do.
Thanks, Justine.
Have a great day.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
And for those of you who are still listening, I, again, want to tell you how much I enjoyed having Natasha on the show today. I appreciate all your phone calls. For anybody that we didn't get to, I'm really sorry about that because we have a certain amount of time. I just want to remind everyone who is in the Los Angeles area to come to our support group on Wednesday nights through CHAD at 2785 Pacific Coast Highway, the Center for Learning Unlimited. Also, for any of you who'd like to contact me, you can do so on my Facebook page at missadd.com, at missadd, and my website is missadd.com. You can also message me directly through the website if you have any questions relating to ADD or co-occurring disorders with them. Next week, we're going to have Robert Roberts on the show. He's a gentleman from New York. And he was diagnosed later on in life, I believe at age 36, with ADD. And he runs, again, a powerful support group in New York. So we've got both coasts covered. And I think it would be very interesting to spend time with him on the phone and on the show so he can let you know about himself and what he does. So, again, thank you, everybody, for listening. I'll be back next week. This is Miss ADD. And remember, please, to stay in the moment.